Hello, this is Liam Schmidt here from Irish Funds. Today we are bringing you the second of a series of recordings from our recent Irish Funds annual conference held in Dublin on May the 18th. We are delighted to share with you this update on regulation panel discussion. The moderator of this session is Brian Fox of JP Morgan, and our panel of esteemed industry regulators include Patricia Dunn from the Central Bank of Ireland, Antonio Baratelli from ESMA, and Camille Blackburn from the FCA. This discussion will address key topics impacting the regulatory environment over the next 12 months, including AIFMD, macroprudential measures, the individual accountability framework, ESG, and operational resilience. I'm sure you'll find the insights to be fascinating, and do keep an eye out for further podcasts shortly from the Irish Funds Annual Conference 2023.
To this panel discussion today on regulation and its effect on the asset management sector. I'm delighted to introduce our expert set of panelists. To my right, we have Antonio Baratelli, who's head of investment management at the European Securities and Markets Authority. Thanks very much for being here. We have Camille Blackburn, director of wholesale buy side at the Financial Conduct Authority in the UK. And finally, Patricia Dunn, Head of Securities and Market Supervision at the Central Bank of Ireland. So thank you very much to the three of you for being here. I think it's fair to say that the asset management industry has demonstrated consistent growth over the past number of years, but at the same time has been dealing with a new set of challenges and events, whether we think about the COVID pandemic, we think about the digital transition, the green transition, and overall citizens engaging with their financing more. I think this might pose, this is all questions and issues that regulation has to deal with and think about. And at the same time, we have policymakers in the EU and in the UK also looking at creating a more robust regulatory framework through maybe and focus on competitiveness, whether LTIF in the EU or Edinburgh reforms in the UK. So we'll try to touch on some of these different topics in today's panel, but there's lots to cover. And I think one of the balances we'll try to reach is what is that balance between competitiveness, investor protection, and financial stability? And maybe on that last point, financial stability, we've seen over the past few months an increased focus from European and global regulators on potential vulnerabilities in the bank and non-banking sectors. We have particular events, for example, March 2020 or LDI in the UK, which are kind of raising some of these questions. So I'd be interested to get your broad thoughts now on overall your views on resilience in the funds sector in the EU and the UK. And maybe I'll start with Patricia for Home Advantage.
Thanks very much. Just a quick mic check. Is this working okay? That's fine. Thank you. I mean, I think when we talk about sort of financial stability concerns in the funds sector, we tend to talk about the recent crisis events. But actually, you know, as a central bank and sort of European regulators have been looking at this far, you know, before that. And I think you nearly have to go back to post the financial crisis, when quite rightly there was a de-risking out of the bank into the non-bank sector, and that was quite deliberate, and that has been very successful, and that brings many benefits in terms of risk diversification, in terms of providing investors with their long-term investment needs, and it has been very successful. But what has also happened is that it has grown exponentially, and certainly I think if you look at in the 2011, 2016 until now, there has been a rapid growth. In Ireland alone, we now have 4 trillion in assets under management. So the resilience and the financial stability concerns about the size of the sector have been around, for the last number of years. And I suppose that was brought into kind of sharp focus when we look at some of the crisis events, including particularly the COVID period, I think, but also some of the more recent things in Russia, Ukraine, and also with the LDI. And while in general, and particularly I think COVID was, I suppose, the most clear example, we certainly did see some of those vulnerabilities that we were concerned about manifesting themselves, and particularly and this is common to all of the events, particularly around funds that have liquidity or leverage risks within them. And I suppose when we talk about the macroprudential framework, I mean, what that is really trying to do is trying to maintain the success of the industry. I mean, this is to the benefit of everybody. And I think what the fund sector has the benefit of, which maybe the banking sector didn't have, the banking sector was creating a legal framework looking backwards into a financial crisis. Now, I'm not saying we are definitely looking forward into a financial crisis, but this is our collective opportunity to prevent or to make sure that if events do occur, that we have the regulatory framework to make the sector more resilient and to make sure that we do not the fund sector does not amplify shocks in the market given its size and scale.
Great, thanks very much. And Antonio, maybe, what are your thoughts on resilience in the sector? Do we have the right toolkit at the moment? I know in AIF&D they're looking at changes on the liquidity management tools. What are your thoughts more broadly on resilience and toolkit available?
Thank you, and thank you very much for the invitation. It's a great pleasure to be here. So indeed, we have indeed learned quite a few things based on the experience in the past year from COVID and most recent crisis that Patricia just mentioned. I believe, just to echo what Patricia just said, the overall looking also at the way things work at European level, the sector has reacted pretty well. We saw, in particular during COVID times, a limited number of suspensions while looking at the global figure of the sector across the EU. So that's a positive signal, but there were some concern linked in particular to certain specific subsectors and assets, just to mention a couple of corporate bonds and real estate, which is still a concern from a financial stability perspective, also looking at the recent work of the ESRB and other institutions. So this is the background, and we need to indeed assess what may come next, which is obviously pretty difficult to do. And we have seen in recent years that there were a number of peripheral events in different areas, and each time there was somehow a stress testing of the market. So looking at the tools, I think indeed, as you mentioned, the AIF&D review will enlarge the spectrum of liquidity management tools that are available, and here there is a great consensus of that need. I think we have learned also throughout the years, in the recent years in particular, we have increased a lot our experience and work on leverage, which is another key area of risk. Within ESMA, we have done a lot of work with our guidelines on leverage, and with the national competent authorities now, we are running every year through exercises where they assess risk linked to leverage in the market, report to us, and we share views, concerns on the situation. So there is somehow an ongoing monitoring in this area, and we have the tool which is already there, the Article 25 tool, where limits can be imposed. And you know very well that the CBI was the first authority to do that at the end of last year, precisely on the real estate sector. So that's a tool that is in place and started being used, might be used more in the future. Stress testing, I think, is also very important. We have already it at micro level. There is quite a lot of focus on that. There may be opportunities to engage in some broader exercise at macro level, possibly in the future. And then finally, I wanted to mention also the importance of reporting, which is not a macro tool as such, but one of the main lessons that we learned from the recent crisis is the importance of data, so of gathering data and portfolio data to monitor the situation on a live basis. So we welcome very much the changes that are brought in by the AIF&D, which much more granular data that will come for the ACE, and the introduction of the reporting system for uses. It will be something quite challenging also for the regulators to put that in place, plus we'll have to do a cross-sectoral study also to ensure that we streamline reporting requirements, but it's clearly a priority for us as ESMA in the context of our renew priority, where we put a lot of focus on data and the use that regulators do of data to drive data-driven supervision.
Thanks very much for that. And Camille, Antonio mentioned the LDI situation as a kind of a real-life stress test. I'm interested in your thoughts on whether regulatory action is needed, how you're thinking about the response to LDR?
How are we thinking about some of the things that we experienced over that period? Yeah, thanks for the question. And thank you for having me here in Dublin today, the FCA in Dublin today. And I just should say I didn't realise the weather was so fantastic in Dublin. So I'll go back with that message for everyone in the UK to
That's
come here for
like
a
this.
Holiday. Yeah. LDI, that was, as you say, it was a real-life stress test. It is, as Patricia has already talked about, an interesting time to be in regulation, and some of these macro-prudential experiences that we've had, a series of them over the last... We've had a few one-in-100-year events over the last year or so, and each time we learn different things about it. I suppose one of the key learnings for us, and both of you have mentioned this in the comments you've already made, Antonia and Patricia, is how important with these macro-prudential events or these market disruption type events is the importance of communication. So in the UK, as well as at the CBI, as well as ESMA, all of us spend a lot of time developing in those international relationships. They, of course, go up into things like FSB and IOSCO. And IOSCO and FSB have got a very, very busy agenda over the next year or so looking at some of these more macro-prudential issues informed by some of the experiences that we've had over the last year or so. We look sideways. So LDI, one of the lovely things, and there weren't many lovely things, but one of the lovely things that was off the back of LDI was the communications and the discussions that we had across borders and with fellow regulators. So those communication channels increase and those discussions deepen about the types of issues that we see emerging in the market looking forward. And then you mentioned also Antonio, the issue of data collection. So with macro-prudential issues, of course, all of us are looking at data and how we can better leverage the data, the quite significant data that you all now submit to us on a regular basis, and how we can interrogate that data looking for issues that might be coming at us. But we're also looking, and we've also got the door open about how we should refine that data so that the burden is more targeted towards those risks that we can anticipate over the next few years.
Thank you. And yesterday we saw the European Commission adopt a memorandum of understanding with cooperation with the UK. So we might see this increased cooperation and communication going forward as well in a more structured way. So.
Yeah, so I think the MOU is an example of that, but you'll see that happening across finance, particularly in relation to these types of market disruption events. You'll see that happening more globally as well.
Yeah, that's reassuring. Yeah. We touched on AIFMD several points already. Other aspects under that proposal is on loan origination and also delegation. I think it's quite advanced in its in the process. I think it's heading towards what's in EU Brussels parlance was called trialogues. So how does your assessment of how this review of AIFMD has gone, in particular around maybe the issue of delegation of portfolio management to global centres, which I think is of particular interest to Ireland. Maybe for start off with Antonio on that one.
Sure. Well, overall, I think the review was actually an opportunity to, I would say, upgrade various elements of the AIFMD. Certainly not overhaul, which I think was welcomed by many stakeholders. Now, indeed, there are still debates, discussion going on certain aspects. Indeed, you mentioned loan origination, where indeed there are political discussion on whether to impose certain restrictions in terms of leverage, whether this can be open-ended or not. So, but I would want enter into this because, of course, that's more a political decision, but just to flag that somehow it fits into the discussion that we just had on macroprudential and financial stability. Of course, on origination is very important from a CMU perspective to foster participation into capital markets, but one needs to keep an eye also on the financial stability elements. When it comes to delegation, well, maybe as a first thing to mention that in 2020 we issued an opinion, a letter to the European Commission suggesting certain changes. I will say, and I'm repeating these since then, there was a certain, I think, misperception of what we claimed for as ESMA, because there was a certain perception that ESMA was against delegation as such, which is not the case. We fully recognize that this is entrenched in the way the business in the asset management sector is set up, but there is a need, and actually for us, actually is mandated by our funding regulation to ensure that there is a consistency in the way the provisions are applied across the EU. And so we suggested a number of clarification that could have helped in ensuring a more harmonized approach across the EU and more supervisory convergence. So on a number of elements, including clarifying the extent to which delegation may be allowed, clarifying whether secondment type of arrangement may be a way to circumvent certain provisions, how to deal with conflicts of interest, in particular in white label situation, and so on. So that was our view. Now, where we are, the AFMD review process took somehow a slightly different path in the sense that the focus was very much on providing regulators with additional information on delegation, which is, I think, certainly a positive development. Now, we still need to see how this ends up, the way this will be reported, whether the way at the moment of authorization or through the AFMD reporting, that's still being discussed in Brussels. But I think it's something that could inform our further work as collectively as regulators. And on certain aspects that I raised earlier on, we need to see how things evolve in the trialogue, because, for instance, there are certain proposals on the Parliament side on white label and other elements. Here, it will be agreed at political level, but we stand ready on our side to keep on the supervisory work.
And there's also, I think, a conversation around costs and charges as well. And I know ESMA yesterday issued an opinion on this topic. I wonder if you want to give us a bit of an insight to that.
Yeah, sure. Indeed, this is one of the amendments that were proposed on the Parliament side to take the opportunity to somehow tweak the provision on cost to provide more disclosure to investors and assess the level of costs across the EU. It's one of the areas where we have put a lot of focus. We issued indeed just yesterday an opinion to the Commission suggesting some changes in both UCITS and AFMD that could help in clarifying the notion of undue costs. We see these in our broader strategy to foster the protection of investors. So we believe this is a very important element. And I think, yeah, it's also connected to the CMU. If you want more retail participation, we need to ensure that costs are fair to investors. So we hope that this will be picked up by the Commission. You know that also the Commission is working on the retail investment strategy. We expect a proposal to come up very soon. So this is to be seen how it will evolve and the interaction between the retail strategy and the AFMD and UCITS review.
So that's probably the better place for that conversation to take place. Interesting. And Patricia, maybe invite you on AIFMD and delegation.
But just generally in terms of AFMD and in terms of European legislation generally, this is an international industry, so we're hugely supportive of the goals of, increased harmonization and supervisory convergence. And I think everybody, again, you're operating in different countries and everybody benefits from that. So definitely completely supportive of the AFMD review in that regard. And I think the areas that it's focusing on have also been a focus for the central bank. As Antonio said, conflict of interest is a huge issue for us and for the industry. And delegation has, been the focus of central bank engagement for some time. And, we're continuing to focus on things like effective governance and oversight and proper substance. And even when we see things happening like the crises, it really focuses the mind when you're engaging with management companies, and you can see the ones that really have that expertise and oversight and can talk sort of expertly to us in the central bank about what's going on in their management company, and sadly some who may not and who are overly relying on their delegates. So we see that in day-to-day supervision as well. And I think certainly when you look at the changes in the the Irish industry and within management companies. We see an increased use of MiFID services. We see increased use of third-party management companies. These are neither good nor bad developments. Just from our perspective, it's just a shift in where the risk is, and we need to follow that in terms of our regulatory framework and our supervisory engagement.
I think a lot of this might go down to governance, which I know is a key topic that Camille is looking at in the FCA in a recent portfolio letter from earlier this year. Any thoughts on how governance ties into also this debate on litigation?
Yeah, so you're right. So anyone in this room that does read very widely would have clocked our portfolio letter, which is part of the regulatory cycle that we have in the UK for oversight of all firms, all regulated firms in the UK. There's a two-year cycle of portfolio letters that go out that talk quite clearly about what we see the clear and present dangers are that are manifesting in the system and how we will approach our supervision of those. And the number one issue that we talked to in that letter this year, that it was released in January, was governance. And the reason why we like all regulators are quite focused on governance is simply because we think it's the most powerful tool in the system to pull. So once you've identified what a risk is within the system that's emerging, like liquidity risk, for example, is one that all of us have spent a bit of time talking about recently. If you can ask in all of our firms, the first four questions we will ask when we go to firms about any risk topic is who is the responsible manager under our SMCR regime, so our senior management regime, who is the responsible manager in your firm for that type of risk? What is their personal committee, or what is the committee that looks at this type of risk, looks at liquidity risk? What is the board that sits over that challenges the outcomes of that decision making? And show us the management information as it flows through the decision-making committees up to the board. So we will ask for that information flow. So that's how it manifests in our system. It's a core part of the regulatory tool that we will use once we've identified a concern in the system. But going back to alternative investments, it is an issue again for all of us on the stage here. It is a dominant issue at the moment in IOSCO and global forums, and the reason for that is as simple and as hard as that private assets really are becoming a far more significant part of the system, aren't they? So there is a shift, and we all know this in this room, there is a shift from public assets to private assets, and therefore there's a lot of interest in our sector about developing products in that area, that talk to private assets. There's a lot of interest about more information about the sometimes opaque asset classes that sit within those portfolios and products. And there will be a continuing focus on liquidity and valuation issues in that sector.
Thanks very much. And just to remind everyone that you can ask questions through the Slido feature, which will pop up on the screen, and we'll look to go towards them at the end of the session. But maybe on going back to your point on governance, one part of the whole ESG debate, the G and the ESG, we've seen a lot of work over the past few years, especially in the EU side, on sustainable finance. We have SFDR, which a lot of the people in this room now are working towards kind of implementation phase. Maybe if I just stick with you, actually, Camille, also in the UK, we see the green finance strategy and more work. You have a recent consultation as well on funds. What is your overall assessment of how things look going forward in the UK for sustainable finance, having the vantage point of the EU just next door?
Yeah, so people in this room may be aware that we're in the process of developing a labelling regime in the UK. So we're not as quick off the starting block as you in the EU, and in fact we've needed to follow very closely, of course, the developing maturity of the ESG debate as you have had that in the EU and are informed by that. I think globally it would be acknowledged that the EU has been the global forerunner in the ESG debate and a deep policy thinker in that area. Our regime is more focused at labels and about describing ESG-ness simply to consumers. There was a consultation at the end of last year, and the balls are in the air at the moment about how that labelling regime will land, and so we expect that to be in the second half of this year. It is when those policy announcements when those policy announcements will be made. Yep.
Great. Thank you. I don't think Antonio in the EU or we have SFDR in place, but I know ESMA has a consultation put out on fund naming as well around ESG and sustainability related terms. Perhaps we'll see a review of SFDR in the next Commission mandate. But right now, what are your thoughts on this work around on fund names from an ESG perspective?
Yeah, it's clearly a very important piece of work for us, one of our top priorities. And the reason is that basically also going back to what Camille said on the labeling regime, actually the way SFDR was set up is that it's not a labeling regime, it's a disclosure regulation. Yeah. But we are aware that ever since the entry into force of SFDR, there was a certain trend of using SFDR categories as marketing tools, as labels, in particular the Article 8 and Article 9 categories. And we are all conscious of certain ambiguities and uncertainties that remain within SFDR. So the fact that a fund is categorized in particular as an Article 8 is not necessarily a guarantee of the greenness of that fund. So that's the SFDR framework, and for the time being we have to live with it. We have not, as ESMA, the power of changing things in that front. But what we felt the need to do together with the national competitors is to act on specifically on the names of the fund that we all know is quite an important, if not main, marketing tool to ensure that whenever certain names having an ESG or sustainability related connotation is used, this is supported by actual underlying investment that match in a way or another with that name. And so it was a way to address greenwashing risk in funds, bearing in mind the current SFDR constraint. And that's why our proposal was to set up some thresholds that are linked to the SFDR categories and disclosure requirements. Now, we have closed our consultation. We received quite a large number of responses, 130. We are still digesting these. There were different views expressed. On the industry side, many criticized the approach, in particular the threshold that we proposed. Some were supportive. On the NGOs, investor association, there was also more support for the work. We are still, as I said, digesting. We'll need to discuss with national competitors on the way forward. And so at this stage, I cannot say anything on the actual final approach that we'll take there. But just to highlight that it's a very important piece, and precisely to deal with the interim situation, so to say. So we know that the Commission might look at SFDR. They announced they will run a consultation this year, but this will be a longer process. So any review of SFDR will take, as usual, a few years, in particular up until it's implemented. I think we're talking about 4 or 5 years, if not more. So our pressing need to act was to fill in the gap in the interim period of time, and so that's our driving factor.
And maybe just sticking with you on SFDR implementation, how do you see that, and more broadly the implementation of the EU sustainable finance strategy? How do you see that going from your perspective? I think a lot of us are ensuring that we're aligned to that. How do you feel?
Yeah, that could be a long debate, but no, it's fair to say that there are a number of challenges. As I said earlier, also a number of unclarities. We have been working quite hardly together with the other ESAs, because just a reminder, this is joint work with EIOPA and EBA, also to try to clarify a number of aspects, in particular related to SFDR. Whenever issue require interpretation of union law, we address the Commission, and you know that the Commission issue a number of interpretative Q&As even very, very recently. There are still a number of issues that may have to be fixed at the level one through any type of changes in SFDR, but in the meantime we need to implement the existing framework. I think since the beginning of this year we have also an enlarged set of rules with level two that enter into force, and now together with national competent authorities we are actually looking on how this is implemented in practice. We'll start a supervisory exercise across the EU, so-called common supervisory action on this area for this year and next year on ESG disclosure. It has already been identified, ESG disclosure, a topic for the so-called union supervisory priority, so there is a lot of attention on the supervisory community across the EU on this topic, acknowledging the challenges for both the industry and regulators, but in the meantime there is a need to actually implement these rules, but certainly fixing the uncertainties, contradiction that may exist within the different pieces of legislation, and acknowledging the challenges for the industry to cope with this is one of our priorities in ESMA, part of our strategy. And we acknowledge also that the sequencing that these various pieces of regulation came out was not ideal, with corporate reporting coming just after SFDR. Of course, this is all known, but in the meantime, we need to cope with the existing framework.
I think that's one of the big messages from the industry has been around the sequencing from the beginning. Maybe Patricia, how do you see this in the Irish context, especially about implementation? But have we got the balance right between the need for regulation on the area of sustainability?
Yeah, I mean, I think, obviously a significant priority for the central bank as well as ESMA. And I think what's slightly different about, I'm going to focus more on SFDR, I know there's broader legislation, is that generally when a new piece of legislation is brought in, there's a sort of an implementing phase, and there's a time where products get launched over time, and industry and regulators come together and in sort of understanding and implement, sort of interpretive issues. But I think the pace and the speed of demand for ESG products has outpaced the development of the legislation, and that has created challenges for everybody. And as Antonio said, in Europe they're already looking at ways, and in the UK as well, looking at ways to improve that legislative framework to make it more consistent and more harmonised, even around some basic definitions. But that said, products are being launched all the time. There is huge demand. So we have to deal with that right now. As Antonio said, the legislative process is going to take some time. And while it can look at it as quite a complicated area when you look at taxonomies, there is a kind of a fairly basic definition of greenwashing, which is where you don't clearly and accurately reflect the underlying profile of your fund. That's just that's very clear, that's very basic. And that's a principle that applies to every fund, if it was not, even funds that are not ESG. Naming conventions apply to all funds that are not ESG. So I think we focus on the basics of, in terms of products, in terms of your disclosure, in terms of your due diligence around investment, and in terms of your engagement with investors. And I should mention there's also a CSA will be conducted I actually can't remember if it starts this year or next year. But in terms of, and that will be across Europe, and in terms of us as a central bank, when we engage on these issues, they're the principles that we will be focusing on. In addition, we're not going to ignore the legal requirement. There are some basic legal requirements, but the principles are also really important to remember.
Thanks very much for that. We have a few questions coming through now. I think some related back to our first discussion point about macroprudential measures, especially at the international level. IOSCO and FSB are assessing some measures, and the question is, do you think the review should go beyond liquidity and leverage? Who would like to take that? Maybe Camille, would you like to?
So the trifecta I would add there would be valuation. So in some of the market disruptions events that we've seen, particularly in relation to private markets, the approaches toward liquidity and liquidity in particular are now becoming sort of broadly recognised, and the standards are becoming fairly consistent globally. I think in issues like valuation and valuation frequency, particularly for longer dated assets or for structures that have a longer investment horizon, I think valuation is shaping up as another issue that we will all be spending a bit of time talking about. Yep.
Antonio.
If I may compliment on this, because indeed it's a very important topic that didn't come up yet, but yeah, valuation is an area of focus since quite a few years, including at our level with work that we have conducted over the years. I mentioned earlier on specific areas of concerns on real estate and corporate bonds. And since the COVID time, we have been doing these supervisory exercise with a lot of focus on valuation. There is actually an exercise that we ran last year, another CSA that focused on valuation. Actually, I can announce that we'll publish very, very soon, I believe already next week, our report on this, which will include more detail. But overall, indeed, the exercise show a good level of compliance across the EU, but still with certain concerns in specific areas such as private equity and real estate. And I think it's something that we as regulatory community, but also industry, we need to keep a close eye on, in particular given the current market situation and economic outlook.
Okay, hot off the press. We'll keep an eye out for that report next week. And Patricia.
If I could add one more thing, it would be interconnectedness. Because I think people forget that one of the biggest investors in funds is other funds. And what we've also seen during the times of stress is that funds that didn't have liquidity and leverage concerns, like money market funds, for example, were significantly impacted by these events. So that would be something that I think from a systemic perspective, I think we should also consider.
Great. Thanks. And maybe one last question on post-trade settlement, T+1. I don't know. So the question is, the US is moving to T+1 settlement. Are you considering a move to T+1 and eventually to T? I think there's conversations happening on that question both in the UK and then separately in the European Union. I think both jurisdictions are definitely looking at the US, even though the UK and EU markets are quite different, I think it's important to say as well. Who would like to respond to that in particular?
I don't think I can.
Okay.
Yeah, but you're absolutely right. We are certainly looking at it, and it will be a very, very important market development that all of us will be spending time looking at over the next little while. But very difficult.
Yeah, I mean it's all about operational risk and practicalities around this. You know, I mean things are good ideas in theory, but can you operationalize it? I mean. But I know very little about this as well, so it doesn't stop me talking about it, but I'm going to stop.
We could talk about it. I think it's going to be affecting the sector overall. The last question is around AIF and DO review, which I think we've broadly covered. It's are you concerned with the pace of the AIF and DO review? Will it be completed before the end of the mandate? As many people might know in this room, the European Commission's mandate is coming to the end early next year, let's say, so there's a limited time left. I think things are going for, it's more of a political question than one for our panelists. But I think just more broadly, again, with this MOU in place, do we feel like going forward? I'd be interested in getting Antonio's thoughts on this, because we spoke about it earlier on this UK-EU dialogue. Do you see a lot more lessons learned being shared between both jurisdictions in terms of how the regulatory systems are changing as we move into the next horizon?
Yeah, well, on these last points, of course, well, since Brexit, the FCA is no longer a part of our discussion, but we keep the dialogue open, so we have frequent exchanges, including on hot topics, so to share views and also progress on the policy work. Then we may depart on specific areas that somehow part of the game. But I would say at regulatory level, the dialogue is very open and quite important, including on data aspect that we mentioned earlier on. How the way work in practice, indeed. The MOUs are very important. There is the one that was agreed already many years ago, which is very important for the investment management sector, among other things. And maybe, yeah, just to try to, well, actually not reply, but the question that was asked, mm-hmm. indeed, on the AFMD review is very much dependent on the political agreement at this stage. I must say that, yeah, having looked at the Council and Parliament text, they weren't so far apart, but the Parliament, yeah, introduced a number of new suggestions on white label calls that we mentioned earlier on. Also, this idea of introducing independent directors, which weren't in the Council text, which I think is, and I should say that we are not part of the travel legislation as ESMA, of course, but I think these are probably the elements that are keeping the discussion going on. And let's see, let's hope that this is finalized soon.
Patricia, do you want to react to any of those points?
No, just to say, yeah, I mean, we're hopeful because there doesn't seem to be any big disagreements on any of the issues. But yeah, you should say, unless something comes in last minute. But yeah, we are hopeful.
Well, Tony, you mentioned the importance of dialogue between the UK and the EU. And with that, we appreciate your dialogue with the industry from all three of you being with us here today on this panel. Lots of important topics that will be looked at over the next 12 months, I think. And so we appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us and your time today. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.